Thank you for that warm introduction, and thanks everyone for being here today on a not so warm day, but at least New York City knows how not to close down when there are a couple of inches of snow on the ground, unlike Texas, where they regularly close schools as soon as anything white comes out of the sky. That's great for the kids, of course, but it is a bit tough for the rest of us. When I think about the Fashion Institute of Technology, I think about the Royal Institution. Now, how's that for a start? The Royal Institution was founded in the late 18th century as a place where patrons, theoreticians, and artisans could be together in what one commentator has described as a kind of social choreography. The idea was that, unlike the Royal Society, which is where Isaac Newton would hang out and grouse about his colleagues, this was a place where the makers, the knowers, the doers, and the funders could all circulate together. There was a little glitch in the initial construction of the Royal Institution. That glitch was a separate staircase built for the artisans because they might disrupt the proceedings with their sweaty palms as they came in with their instruments and the dirt under their fingernails while Sir Isaac Newton and the patrons were holding forth. I am pleased to say that that staircase and that separate entrance were never completed. Instead, the Royal Institution was the place where the makers, the knowers, the funders all became one in their activities. And I salute you for having that same ethos in the work you do. Nevertheless, the title is Faculty 2020 with a couple of little puns in there that are not very subtle. One, of course, is that as you think of faculty of the future, you're thinking not near-term, you're thinking long-term. Always difficult to do, of course, especially when change is proceeding as rapidly as it is, and yet necessary as well, because the folks you're going to see entering your school in 2020 are already in school. They're already living at an accelerated rate of change. They are in many ways alien to the world that we grew up in, those of us of a certain age, and yet they are our children. They are the folks who are coming in. They are the folks we need to think about. And the other, of course, pun in there is that we need to have 2020 vision. We need to have our vision sharpened somehow. That's easy to do in hindsight, a little bit harder to do with foresight. So let's start with the easy one. The Academy blew it with this fellow. How did that happen? Can we learn from this bit of academic misconduct and figure out what we may be missing as we look ahead? This, of course, is William Shakespeare, who was vilified by the faculty of his day because he had no degree. He had the nerve to come up from a provincial town and, in the words of one particularly envious and scolding reviewer, was an upstart crow beautified with our feathers, meaning that he had the nerve to come in and write plays in blank verse and pretend to a kind of elevated diction and loftiness of thought that belonged only to those from Cambridge and Oxford and, well, maybe the University of London if you really want to dig deep. This was the criticism. This man is not one of us. We don't know where he came from. We don't know his credentials. In fact, we're not even sure of his identity today, but leave that aside for a moment. He didn't get all of his facts straight. He hadn't done his thorough work in the Greeks and Romans and understanding all of the ways these plays needed to be put together very neatly and precisely. One of his great rivals, Ben Jonson, famously criticized him for writing a play in which Bohemia had a coast. And everybody should have known that Bohemia was landlocked. He didn't even have his facts checked well. Oh, for the red pen to mark up Shakespeare's masterpieces. And yet, this is the one we read. This is the one we perform. This is the one we treasure. This is the greatest genius, aside maybe from John Milton, but I won't get into that, that English literature has produced. Yet for many, many years, centuries even, he was looked down upon as someone who, well, he was part of the theater company and he made money with his masterpieces. And as one of my colleagues pointed out, he was one of the few geniuses the world has produced who actually retired to a nice country home he had bought for himself. How dare he do that? How unlike us who will be dropping dead at our desks red pens in hand. But you see, this fellow was writing in a disreputable genre. The idea that plays would constitute literature. Plays, you know, the plays they put on the wrong side of the river. Plays like Hamlet in its first run, which if you wanted to see it, you'd have to cross that Thames, go to the other side where they kept the riffraff, and not to put too fine a point upon it, you'd have to elbow your way past the whores and the pickpockets and all the serving maids dressed up in their ladies' finery to be able to get inside the Globe and see Hamlet in its first run. Now, if you want to make the world safe for the kind of work the pointy-headed intellectuals like myself like to do, our red pens in hand, then you're going to have to wait centuries for it to be pasteurized and homogenized. If you want to see, instead, Hamlet in its first run, you're going to have to go to a place you might not suspect genius to emerge, deal with genres that are not yet reputable, and elbow your way through people you might not be seen with otherwise to get to see genius in its first flowering. So the Academy blew it with William Shakespeare. And we continue to be capable of blowing it. I'm an English professor, so I like to pick on my own tribe. Let me bring it up to the present. Some of you may have seen in late December an article on cultural genomics. It was covered in The Guardian. I think The Times had a piece on it as well. It was an article that came out in Science magazine on the quantitative analysis of culture using millions of digitized books. And the idea was, as Google put it together, you would be able to search the corpus, a very tiny bit of the large publication count that had existed in English publication from around 1500 to the present, but you'd be able to search some little bit of it and begin to decry some cultural trends by looking at word frequency counts, what they called n-grams. You can see here with this little n-gram that El Dorado, as a kind of utopia, never land, begins to decline in popularity somewhere around, 1920 or so, and Atlantis picks up in popularity. Now, who knows what that means? To find its meaning is what the interpreters will do, but it's interesting. It's just not interesting to the faculty, at least the Miltonists I deal with. This, of course, is on a Milton listserv. The ironies are endless, but I won't belabor them. Fellow scholars, one of my fellow scholars writes, I read this in today's Guardian about two culturomics. And you know, the scare quotes already mean, take this from me. Researchers at Harvard who are using Google data and dollars. Yes, those dollars. To study the English language genome. And then there's a quotation. And my fellow scholar goes on, let's talk a bit about terms like culturomics and genome and the apparent need to sound like a scientist, death to English majors everywhere, a wacky scientist at that, in order to be taken seriously by the media and government grant dispensers these days, meaning why don't they shovel some of that money to us deserving Miltonists who proceed very deliberately, red pens in hand, and will never cross the Thames. Someone else writes in, I've mercifully obscured his identity, a senior scholar of some renown, full caps, yes indeed, something should be done to combat such nonsense. Why not write a letter to the Guardian that lots of us could sign? Best, and then, I really won't say his name. Sure, let's do that, and we can with King Canute go down to the seashore and bid the sea hold its peace and not come in. This occasioned some great gnashing of teeth on the listserv. Culturomics is the application of high-throughput data collection and analysis to the study of human culture. Sounds brutal. Sounds toxic. One person on the Milton listserv said, essentially, they're making up these words. Could somebody explain to me what high-throughput actually means? Because I am foolish and naive, I wrote in and attempted to do so. What I did not, because I am kind, point out is that if one had gone to the Oxford English Dictionary, one would have found that the Scottish National Dictionary has the first entry for throughput from 1808. This is a reference tool beloved of Miltonists, but no one in their high dudgeon or their fear or their sense that somehow this just wasn't right, no one went there to see what it was they were complaining about, and whether it was just the evil scientists making this up, or whether this was something that we could actually pay attention to and learn from. I think what we have to combat, especially when we think about these information and communication technologies that are revolutionizing our world, creating disruptions such as we have not seen for centuries, I think what we have to beware of as faculty is administered intellectuality. That's the phrase of James Fernandez in an article that you can get online for free. I recommend it to you. It's called Edification by Puzzlement. And he writes, "We should always be wary of the imperial impulse, the possibility that any interest in mentalities is betrayed by a pre-existent interest in maintaining and justifying a structure of privileges, that separate entrance that we get to go in as faculty." That sits very uneasily next to words by Clay Shirky, just down the road, who said in 2008, and I think if anything, this is truer today, "We are living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race." To me, that's quite exciting. It's thrilling, but it is disruptive. It does lead to chaos. Typically, that's compared to the advent of print, something like the Gutenberg Bible, which caused massive social unrest, political change of a degree unprecedented before this widespread literacy became the rage. Kings and queens had their heads cut off. Religious orthodoxies toppled. People actually took sacred books into the pubs and read the naughty bits aloud and laughed. True, that's what people were afraid of. It's exactly what happened. And yet, none of us today would say, gee, if we could just roll the clock back and get rid of this foolish mass literacy idea, we'd have a stable society. We've embraced this as part of the democratic impulse, as part of what leads to social justice, individual self-actualization. I think, following Doug Engelbart, who said it first, that we're not looking at a revolution on this scale. We're looking at a revolution on the scale of the phonetic alphabet, of writing itself, which changed humanity forever. It was a technology invented, among other things, for communicating with the dead, which it turns out is a very advantageous thing to be able to do. We don't have to start over from scratch every new life that emerges. We can learn from the past, at least we hope. Last night, the State of the Union address indicated some of the extent of this connectivity, this increased expressive capability. If you watched it on television, an old information and communication technology, you didn't see the whole State of the Union address. You had to go onto the World Wide Web, where there was, as you can see, a standard and an enhanced State of the Union address available. The enhanced version had various kinds of charts, various kinds of graphs, various kinds of illustrations. Over there on the right of the image, so far that's kind of a lecture with PowerPoint. That's pretty good. Scroll down. There's a White House app. There are opportunities for asking questions. There's something today, after the State of the Union address, or rather last night, after the State of the Union address, you can send in questions, questions on Twitter, questions on Facebook, questions through the web form. Oh, there's also information from the First Lady. There's information today from the press secretary. Another conference call with young Americans. Tomorrow, President Obama answers your questions on YouTube, etc. It goes on. It's easy to be cynical about this. I think it would be a mistake. It indicates, I believe, a profound understanding of the connected world in which we live and the opportunities for those connections to be connected in a network of networks. Notice last night the latest tweet from the White House. Within 25 years, our goal is to give 80% of Americans access to high-speed rail. And then the Twitter marvel, the hashtag, some of the best internet comedy that you can find with some of the fake hashtags out there, but also a way of not only signaling the content of the message, but enabling a feed of that message, to be directed wherever you would like it to go, onto your web page, into a class site, onto your own private domain. It doesn't matter. That little hashtag, that little pound, S-O-T-U, is a magic device, not built into Twitter, but emerging from the user's adaptation of Twitter as it has gone along. That's my daughter underneath. That's her tweet to me. Hashtag State of the Union, hashtag innovation. Mention at Gardner Campbell. That's my username. The mention is also something that the users adapted in Twitter. It was not built in when Twitter debuted, but Twitter noticed that users were beginning to make this a convention, and they thought, why not make it easy for the thing that the users would like to do to be done? Why not make that a link, which it now is? And I can see from this little message something pretty heartwarming for this father. When my 16-year-old daughter, watching the enhanced State of the Union on her computer, thinks of me, she thinks of innovation. She thinks of the State of the Union, knitting those events and those attitudes together in one tweet, which is highly meaningful to me. But of course, it's disruptive as well. Underneath that, we have The Onion telling us that if you have an HD TV, we recommend going to menu and lowering your set saturation values 15% to compensate for boner. The Borowitz Report tells us to tweet about the president's speech, use pound S-O-T-U. To tweet about Michelle Bachmann's response, use pound S-T-F-U. And then side by side with all of that, from our president, if you want to make a difference in the life of our nation, if you want to make a difference in the life of a child, become a teacher. So there it is. There's the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. Profound calls to action, satire, parody, jokes, my daughter. They're all in there, all together. What sense can we make of it? Well, that's the question, but we're not going to answer it by simply turning it off. That's not going to happen, and it's not fair to us or to our students. Speaking of the White House, let's talk gaming. Let's talk Little Big Planet. Anybody here played Little Big Planet? Okay, Little Big Planet actually was singled out by the U.S. Department of Education as a way to teach science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. What is Little Big Planet? It's a game for the Sony PlayStation 3. Why would you use it as a platform to teach science, technology, engineering, and mathematics? Because it is a game with a difference. It's a game that includes tools to create more levels of the game, something like an education. So how does that work? People using Little Big Planet, when they get to the end of the game, now use the tools to create more levels, but they also can upload those levels to the server run by the gaming company, where those levels can be tagged by author, tagged by, are they ingenious, frightening, bizarre, surreal? You can apply little indicators what kind of a level it is. You can also rate them, 2-star level, 3-star level, 4-star level. The community developing these levels begins to rank, begins to assign reputation, begins to share in meaningful ways these creations. And who's making these creations? The players of the game, who are themselves also the architect of the game, the architects of the game. And how committed are these architects? The game's released in October 2008. 9 months later, 1 million user-created levels have been uploaded. 7 months later, we're at 2 million levels. 6 months after that, 3 million levels. Let's say for the purpose of argument, 95% of these are bad. That still leaves more fascinating levels than you can get through in probably the time that you'd like to allocate to gaming. There's more riches there than you can possibly encounter. And who's getting paid? Not the creators, not in money anyway. They're getting paid because they love what they're doing and they can share it. It's the sharing, it's the connectivity that makes this happen. Not the closed experience, and when you get to the end, you get your final score or your degree. It's the platform for creation, the platform for connectivity that makes this so involving and engaging. When we think about education, we tend to think in very linear ways, as Stephen Johnson talks of in The Invention of Air. We are very addicted to the idea that you start with confusion, there's a light bulb moment, and you proceed to clarity. Or if we want to get a little more exotic and Hegelian, we have a thesis and an antithesis, and we lead to synthesis. Johnson points out, no, it's the connectivity. It's the network. To the extent that you can enable those connections, not only within a class, but across classes, across institutions, across national boundaries, across the boundaries of age, involving, let's say, in a particular class, not only the students and the faculty, but the staff. What about the alumni? What about the trustees? What about the schools in China? Is there a way those connections can happen? And if they do, how does the teacher proctor them all? Answer, the teacher does not. The teacher facilitates the platform and the connections. Not all of this has to be flowing through the person at the front. Louis Pasteur famously said of science, chance favors the prepared mind. Stephen Johnson, again in the new book called Where Good Ideas Come From, emphasizes that chance favors the connected mind. And I'm convinced that the technologies we have in front of us now, the technologies we have in our pockets, the technologies we wear on our wrists, the technologies that are so disruptive, just mindlessly churning themselves through our lives, nevertheless represent an important idea, which is that we are who our connections are. Instead of looking at the neural map of the brain, in this TED talk, the neuroscientist Sebastian Sung emphasizes that we are not simply the neurons, we are the connections among the neurons, and we are now able to model those synaptic connections. More possibilities there than there are stars in the known universe. It is that pattern of connections which we as faculty are responsible for enabling for our students that make us who we are. These connections, it seems to me, form a platform for what Paul Sylvia, a cognitive psychologist at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, terms the knowledge emotions. This is not about the delivery of content, though content, of course, is important. It's about what happens when those connections are present, when those connections are encouraged. They are knowledge emotions like interest, which is an emotion, not just a mental state. And it's an easy thought experiment to get that around, get your head around that. If you think of boredom, that's a feeling. We know what that's like. Interest, too, is an emotion. We tend to cock our heads when we're interested. We tend to lean forward a little bit. The galvanic response of our skin changes. Thinking of it that way, not just as something that happens in our minds, seems to me to point in useful ways to how we might think about teaching and learning. Surprise is a knowledge emotion. And the thing that, of course, gets us off track, how can we continue with the syllabus or the plan for the day or all the things we need to cover? Well, the surprise is sometimes getting off track, digressing, allowing the student's interest to propel that particular class meeting yields much greater benefits than getting to the end of what we had planned. Confusion is a knowledge emotion. The indicator that learning has begun, not that learning has not yet started. And awe is a knowledge emotion. The extent to which we can include these by means of information and communication technologies in the work we do as faculty is the extent to which we are responding to this moment, it seems to me, but also learning from the past not to repeat the mistakes that we have made. This would be the opposite of a platform for knowledge emotions. And yet this is common as dirt among institutions of higher learning. It's actually gone down into the high schools now. You may recognize it. It's a learning management system, as if the students are our employees and somewhere there's a punch clock. If you can't see it, they can. Ask them how many credits it takes to graduate. They know. Right? That's how many hours they need to do. Look at this. And I have to say, The people who run these systems are fine people. They're doing things that they believe are important. And we, of course, enable them because we believe this is important. And yet, we can't quite face the reality of what we're looking at. The URL here is my.baylor.edu. That's what a student types to get into that particular learning management system. But that's not their learning management system. We may want to think it is, but it isn't. It's the ILI. It doesn't have anything to do with them. There have been no institution announcements in the last 7 days, no course announcements in the last 7 days, no organization announcements have been posted in the last 7 days. And of course, all the courses on the right are unavailable. At least no tasks are due. In your mind, put that next to a little big planet. You see the difference? This has nothing to do with connectivity. In fact, the students' work vanishes semester by semester. But that's because the work only exists for a semester. No, none of us want this, but this is what we have devolved ourselves into, largely for convenience sake, but also I would offer because in keeping things straight and keeping things managed and keeping things neat, we've drained the life's blood out of what we're doing. Thank you. Do you have any openings on your faculty? So what happens when we set up a system so easily and profoundly gamed? We use these signature pedagogies of, in my case, of course, the term paper. And now you can go online and buy your own term paper. The number of pages is there for you, the urgency, the academic level, the subject area, the number of sources, what quality are you buying? Urgent term papers like Great Leaders, Are They Born, Are Made, the Best Practices Supervisor's Manual, and my favorite rhetorical question, Are Men Necessary? I wish that had been premium quality, but alas, there's only one source, and it's standard quality. Maybe next time. This is one site. There are dozens, hundreds perhaps, of these sites out on the net. And they point to something that at its worst, yes, is egregious, and yet is, I think, a fair symbol for what we're asking, something transactional, something manufactured in the worst possible sense. Or as one of my colleagues once said, the students pretend to be interested, we pretend to be interested, at the end grades are exchanged and we kiss them goodbye. And when we kiss them goodbye, we can give them the University of Name Here. This also comes from a great website, .nd-center.com. An nd-center.com. We custom design and create fake diploma and fake degrees, so whatever your requirements, maybe we can create high-quality documents to meet your specifications, whether it may be a college degree, high school diploma, or a college transcript. This is not what we want. This is not what we think we're doing. I'm a faculty member. I've sat in those committees where we think about curriculum forever. And at the end of the day, all of that fussing and all of those discussions end up with the University of Name Here. Thank goodness it's the Department of Communication and not the Department of English, but oh well. It's all the same. I had a young woman sitting in my office just last spring saying she was taking 18 credits this semester. And she was falling behind in all of her courses, and she was unhappy. She was taking this overload, and she was not sleeping. She was working 30 hours a week. Nothing was going well for her. And I said, why are you doing this? She said, because I need to get it over with. And I said, get what over with? She said, I need to get the degree. And I said, you're doing more work, enjoying it less. It's as if you're at a gourmet restaurant, and you're trying to feed yourself in 10 minutes. Why are you doing that? She said, I've got to get it over with. I said, so what do you want to do after you graduate? And she said, graduate school. And you have to laugh to keep from weeping. But there it is, right? She understood how many credit hours it would take to graduate. Instead of a habitat, which flourishes as an ecosystem where the life gives life to itself, where there is a self-stimulating, self-perpetuating, self-organizing network that doesn't necessarily need us as curators the whole way. We've constructed habit trails that our students walk through. All very neat, all very tidy, all very ready for display. We don't mean to do it, and yet, talk to the students. This is the way they perceive a lot of our hard and well-intentioned work. So how can these technologies turn that around? I'm not sure, but I'll give you some thoughts. That's from 1974. I don't think we're there yet. This is Ted Nelson. It's a self-published, it's not peer-reviewed, it was self-published. It was a book called Computer Lib, Dream Machines. It's a really interesting book. You can see Computer Lib and the raised fist on one side, you turn it over and upside down, and it's Dream Machines with a young woman wearing a cape flying into the future. It's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure story. One author has said that it's the most important text ever written in the history of new media. It was so important that people would put it next to new employees at IBM, right there on their desks when they would come in the 1980s. Read this so you'll understand something of the potential of these technologies. And it's a wickedly interesting book. It's got comics in it. It's got TypeScript. It's got handwriting. It's got scribbles. It's got all sorts of footnotes. It's got screeds and rants and careful arguments. And it's quite a mishmash. It's a fascinating document. And in it, Ted Nelson writes, "Education ought to teach and reward initiative, curiosity, the habit of self-motivation, intellectual involvement." Of course it should. And Nelson's thesis was that computers, because of their unique properties, could spur us much better than any technology we'd invented since the book itself in the direction of this kind of education. But he goes on to write, "Educators and computer enthusiasts tend to agree on these goals, but what happens? Many of the inhumanities of the existing system, no less wrong for being unintentional, are being continued into computer-assisted teaching." Like that ILI that I showed you earlier. That's 1974. You'd think we would have caught on, but it took centuries for the Shakespeare thing. We need to be patient, but not too patient. This was in the New York Times late last year. "Learning in dorm because class is on the web. I would submit that this is not the way to use information and communication technologies. If we go in for a close-up of this young man who is in his, he's not in his PJs, but he's dressed down so he can sit in his room, watch the class on TV, not have to go to the class where he's probably sitting at the back of a huge lecture hall. Instead, there you go. There's a network of networks, not what I would call the paradigm of education we should aim for. A teacher, her back to the room, writing on a board, and he is doing exactly what she is doing. There is no connection. There is no knowledge emotion detectable in that particular photo. There is none of that platform for the connected mind. Instead, it's the same old thing. Write it down, which has its uses, of course, but this is a very unidimensional educational encounter. As Seymour Papert wrote in 1995 in a sobering essay called "Why School Reform is Impossible," before the computer could change school, school changed the computer, right? We know that computers don't work because we bring them into business as usual, and somehow that doesn't fit. Somehow they just seem to be a kind of barnacle, a little excrescence there on the side of what we're trying to do. So it's just another nuisance, just another technology to learn, just another currency to master, just something else that we have to fold into our lives. But Papert says, and I think he's right, we don't fully understand what the computer is or what the network can mean. And that's what I want to turn to now. This is Douglas Engelbart. I've quoted him already once. I'd like to quote him again. He's known primarily as the inventor of the mouse, but that's not quite getting at it. That's like saying Da Vinci liked to scribble in notebooks. That's true enough, but Leonardo had a lot more going on than that. Douglas Engelbart, in a 1962 essay called Augmenting Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework, laid out what he had as a vision for the future of interactive computing, a future that he brought into being and demonstrated for the first time in public on December 9th, 1968, at what's called the Mother of All Demos. People thought he was crazy. Why would you have a personal computer? Why would you interact with a computer that would be like a personal helicopter? It wouldn't make any sense. And yet Engelbart had somewhere this epiphany that there was something about the interaction with this machine that was as much like a mind as anything we had ever invented. It would make possible what he called the integrated domain. He writes very movingly in 1962, "We do not speak of isolated clever tricks that help in particular situations. It's not really an app for that kind of guy. We refer to a way of life in an integrated domain where hunches, cut and try, intangibles, and the human feel for a situation usefully coexist with powerful concepts, streamlined terminology and notation, sophisticated methods, and high-powered electronic aids. A kind of symbiosis between the machine and the human being in the service of this integrated domain. To what extent can we allow our students to participate in this integrated domain? To what extent do we understand what this might mean in our own work?" To try to get at this, I've started to talk about this idea I call digital citizenship. It's not my idea alone. There are lots of folks out there tinkering with this as a paradigm for what we might think of preparing our students for. And I'd like to submit today to you, my fellow faculty, that we have to be digital citizens as well. But fear not, we have an American patriot to model ourselves after, Benjamin Franklin, a successful publisher and consummate networker with an inventive curiosity, his biographer writes, who would have felt right at home in the information revolution. Getting back once again to the idea that the making and the knowing and the doing and the funding are all part of one whole in the service of this connectivity, which in the colonies would have meant the newspaper. And there's Franklin at the printing press, Franklin who would cast the type himself, Franklin who would very ostentatiously wheel 200 pounds of newsprint down the hill in a wheelbarrow so everyone would know how industrious he was being, Franklin who wrote and edited the newspaper, Franklin the diplomat, Franklin the scientist, Franklin the polymath, largely self-taught, alas, but I think that if we can design the university we want, we'll find that we won't ruin the Ben Franklins of the future. His surname is interesting. When the English acquired surnames, they would either be their own domain, their landed title, so you get the Lancasters, right? Or it would testify to the work they did, the bakers, the tailors. The word Franklin, the surname Franklin, means a freeholder, someone who is free. And it seems to me that that's what we want for our students. We want that freedom. We want our students to be Franklins, which for the purposes of digital citizenship means what we saw back here. Successful publishers, consummate networkers, inventive curiosity, right at home in the information revolution. We should want this for ourselves as well. It may take some doing. What will it take? Many of us have started to get our heads around information literacy. That's not bad. How can you tell a good website from a bad website? How can you identify the place where the information is reliable? How do you know how to find what you need? Most of us can make our way around a library catalog online now. Some of us will actually do very daring things like use Wikipedia in our own lives. And then the very daring thing, which is not to scold our students for using it, not as a primary source. Never use an encyclopedia as a primary source. But for a general lay of the land, you're not going to be able to do better. But that's just the beginning. We have to get to digital fluency. We have to expand our minds into meta-medium thinking, which I call the digital imagination. We have to be inventive for ourselves to make a personal cyber infrastructure. And all of those things together add up to digital citizenship, or at least in this model. Make your own. Do better than that. Put a comment on my blog, tweet, Send me an email. I don't care. Help me get these ideas to be better. What do these things mean? Information fluency, very easy. This is copyright 2009. I wish it were copyright 2000. I wish we'd moved a little farther along, but you can see this is pretty familiar. The American Council of Research Libraries does this. You'll find this around in lots of places. This is a little harder. When I think of fluency, I think of flow states, that moment when you're at one with the work, where you lose all sense of time, where you find yourself in a heightened state of fullness of being. We have to learn how to do that in the digital domain. It could be with the application of your choice. It could be with reading blogs or writing blogs. It could be with Twitter. It could be with grooming Wikipedia. Whatever it is, that fluency means that this has to be something in which you find fullness of being, not just one more thing to master. Meta-medium thinking is especially difficult. Alan Kay and Adele Goldberg in 1977 trying to work out what the Dynabook would be, which is something that eventually became the laptop we carry around with us, wrote in words that are still very, very exciting to me, but not well understood or not well known. The ability to simulate the details of any descriptive model means that the computer, viewed as a medium itself, can be all other media if the embedding and viewing methods are sufficiently well provided. We think the implications are vast and compelling. In other words, the computer is not simply an appliance. The computer is not simply a tool. It's a platform for tool making, or as Howard Rheingold put it, a tool for thought itself. It's difficult to get to this because we're surrounded by so much tech with small t, but when we think about technology with a capital T and the implications for the computer as a universal machine whose property it is to simulate all other machines, then something very interesting happens. It's almost like a primordial clay out of which we can make anything we can imagine. Seymour Papert, again in the 1995 essay I cited earlier, does a little thought experiment. Movies, textbooks, computers. If this were on an SAT, which of these items doesn't belong? It's probably, we would say, textbook, right? And that would be the mistake. Actually, the computer is the device that doesn't belong in that trio because it is qualitatively different from a book or a movie. It is a meta platform. It is a meta medium. This was well understood and even celebrated in the early days of interactive computing, but such is the grammar of school that we've snapped it back into a big fancy machine for watching movies and reading texts. Very recently, Alan Kay commented on a colleague's blog, trying to sum up what he thought he was doing and what happened instead. And he wrote, "One way to look at what we were doing is that we were trying to make new kinds of books and telescopes and microscopes, etc., to advance seeing and thinking, those basic sensory activities. But if you give a microscope to a monkey, they only will hold it up to admire their reflection in the shiny brass barrel." And I think this is what happened. Education never got on the bus, and the augmentation of human intellect, as he recalls those words of Douglas Engelbart, which is right there, Kay says, got completely overwhelmed by the mirror effect. Back to the essay in 77. This was a moment in which a student of mine got the meta medium. How did that happen? Kay and Goldberg wrote, "Music is controlled in a completely analogous manner. The Dynabook can act as a super synthesizer, getting direction either from a keyboard or from a score. The keystrokes can be captured, edited, and played back. Timbres, the fonts of musical expression, contain the quality and mood which different instruments bring to an orchestration. They may be captured, edited, and used dynamically." And my student read that passage and he said, "Wait a minute. I thought computers were invented and then musicians figured out ways to use them." It was exactly the opposite. Musicians wanted to expand their own capabilities, so they helped invent computers. Right. That's the meta medium. That's how the computer evolved. Now for the personal cyber infrastructure. This is a web hosting service. This particular one comes from Bluehost, but this is something called cPanel. It's very common. It gives you a quick and easy way to click around and manage a web server, to be a sysadmin without being a computer scientist. It's actually quite easy. There are even how-to videos. Why does this matter? Look at all the things you can install with one click. You can install Moodle. You can install several varieties of blogs. You can install project management, forums. It is that meta-medium layer. You own a part of the web. Make a cyber infrastructure here, something that's smaller than the network itself, but larger than any particular application. It costs about $8 a month. Why is this important? This is Vi Hart, again from the New York Times. This is someone who just recently graduated from SUNY Stony Brook. Any of you see this story in the Times about the math doodling? So Vi Hart advertises herself as a mathemusician. And she put a video up on YouTube of the way she likes to doodle in her math classes. And it went viral, over 1 million views. What was that about? Well, I urge you to go look at this on her YouTube channel, where she talks about how she understands math when the class is getting boring. Or you can go to her website at www.vihart.com, where she has bought a space on a web server, where she has a domain of her own. People are now giving these away as baby presents, you know. It's a pretty sweet baby present to give somebody a domain named after the baby. You can keep that with you as a kind of digital identity. This is Vi Hart. This is Vi Hart's everything. This is Vi Hart's personal cyber infrastructure. And there's more. All of that preparing her not for the e-portfolio the school creates for her, but the e-portfolio that expresses her own digital life with three recursive practices. We can do this too. We can narrate our work publicly. And when I talk about this, typically it means blogging, which my colleagues will recoil from. They will say one of two things. I have no time, which is true, but we have to make time for what's important. And who wants to know what I have to say? Which makes no sense to me because we became faculty, because everyone wants to know what we have to say. And they will pay us for it as well. Narrating our work, encouraging our students to tell the story not just of what the finish line was like, but what it was like getting there. Curating that work so that it can be displayed in compelling ways for the sharing to occur, the connecting. All of these things are possible. They're even easy once you get your mind around not the latest tech gadget, but the bigger idea of what this medium can be. And they're going to be most powerful if they engage with the network effects I've been describing on the open web using Web 2.0 affordances. Now, there are tricky bits to this. I know about FERPA. I know about student privacy. I know about the risks of putting things out there on the web. We must be selective. And yet, when it's out there on the open web, some magical things can happen, and I can share them with you. For example, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute has a program called the Science Education Alliance. This is a freshman seminar, runs for 2 semesters. It's an experience in which students come in and they do real data gathering, contributing real data to real databases. They're doing real lab work, not cookbook stuff, with the experiment already figured out. And early on, the 2 teachers at Baylor who were doing this came to me and they said, is there anything else we could do? We want to tell this story in a compelling way. I said, well, have your students blog. And they said, what would they blog? Just put their lab reports up there? And I said, they should tell the story of the discovery. They should tell the story of what's happening as they learn. That's a compelling story. It turns out it's a very compelling story. And this is one of the students' blogs. Notice this is the front page where the blogs are aggregated. That's what the student's blog looks like. No one assigned the title. No one assigned the particular look and feel. It's all trivially easy to give the students the choice of this kind of variety, and it pays off because they have ownership in what they're doing. And then we get an entry just a little while ago, like this one, defending our genes. It was fun to see each other's annotated genes today. I like that we can see each other's work and also help one another throughout the process, etc. I don't know what that means exactly, But I know that student interest is there, excitement, curiosity, wonder, maybe even a little bit of confusion. And I can share it with you. They can share it with each other. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute is now working on ways to get students networking not only within classes, but across all of the cohorts who are engaged in this experiment. That can't happen locked away in a learning management system. Social theory. Everything has to be related to bears at Baylor, so this is social theory. Again, the same idea. Students have their own writing space, and that writing space is theirs, yet it can be fed into and aggregated within a front page for the class with the comments displayed in the sidebar. This is one of the students' about pages for the blog she put together. Again, the front page, the platform for the connections, and yet here's the student's own blog. I'm a senior getting my BA in sociology, and I made this blog for my social theory class. I like that. I made this blog, not I logged onto the system. This is a class I taught fall a year ago. After the class was over and the grades were in, one student still felt compelled to post an open letter to present and future NMSers. And because it's not inside Blackboard, it's there and can be read and was read by the next year's class. Dear Media Nuts, blog, think, do, study, most importantly, learn Adobe. And then in the PS, my favorite, she liked the class, and then she thanks her colleagues before she thanks me. Good. Who would her colleagues be? Her fellow students. This even works for faculty. This is a faculty development seminar that I have done now for two semesters at Baylor and starting up again this semester, in which the faculty are essentially going through the first year seminar, thinking about new media. They're blogging, which is very difficult for them. They're having their work aggregated. They have, on the left sidebar, you can see bookmarks to a central web-hosted bookmarking service called Delicious, which they bookmark using the class tag and whatever other keywords they want to use, and it feeds in automatically into this area, which I call a mother blog. There are the comments on the side. The most spectacular instance of digital, of a personal cyber infrastructure that I know of right now is this course, DS106.us, Digital Storytelling, which has to do with the crafting of one's digital identity online. It's being run by Jim Groom and Martha Burtis at the University of Mary Washington. This is the expectation we should be, in my view, trying to build for our students. John Udell says it well. I'll let him have this word.
Right. How do we get people to expect? And this is completely non-technological, right? It's how do we get people to expect that the information that they have that they want to put into the world is information that they should expect to be able to park at some place on the web that's bound to their identity and that delivers their stuff in a variety of ways that enable it to be seen by people and to flow through networks and get to the places where the people that they want to see it can see it. You know, that's the crux of the whole thing.
That's something our students should be ready to do when they leave our colleges and universities. They should have that expectation. They should have intuitions about the network. They should have the ability to create new levels of the experience they've been through and share them with each other. That, Franklin's important, and hopefully there's some money to be made along the way to keep hearth and home together. But this Franklin, the digital citizen, is the one that we need to have our eyes on. As Janet Murray writes in the introduction to the New Media Reader, the task is the same now as it ever has been. Familiar, thrilling, unavoidable. We work with all our myriad talents to expand our media of expression to the full measure of our humanity. The simple thesis I wanted to share with you today is that I believe computers and networks of those computers give us the most exciting and the most revolutionary approach to that full measure that we as human beings have yet invented. We've only begun to see the potential, both for good and for ill, but I think it weighs a little more on the side of good. It's something that we need to understand at a conceptual level, whatever technologies we choose to use in our own work. And if it's not about expanding our media of expression to the full measure of our humanity, then we should leave it alone. But I think it's something there to explore. It's changed the work I do, both within the classroom and outside of it. And I hope that digital citizenship is, even in this embryonic form, an idea that is at least interesting enough to begin to perhaps change some of the way you think about these gadgets that we carry around. Thank you very much for your attention.